No, he won't take it, said a voice out loud. No, we won't take it, we will stand our ground. No.
Welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show, where we the people are now in session. I have a great show coming up for you today. In the first hour, I will start the show with Yuri Rashkin from Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup. Then I will be speaking with Rob Zerban, who is running against Paul Ryan in the first CD. I will finish the hour with Edna Conkle and Michelle Doolin, who will be talking about the We Are Women's March tomorrow in Madison. In the second hour, I'll start that off with Lisa Graves from Center for Media and Democracy. We'll be discussing ALEC and the MacIver Institute. Then I'll be speaking with Tom Barrett, who is running for governor in the recall. Finally, I'll finish out my show with Kelly Albright from Politiscope, who will be giving updates on the Beau Morrison murder investigation. Phone numbers to call in are 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896. We also have a live discussion online at blogtalkradio.com, where you can post your comments or questions. Now, before I get to Yuri, I just want to make the announcement about the rally tomorrow. It's Wisconsin's Unite Against the War on Women protest. It's a rally scheduled for this Saturday, tomorrow. It's going to be afternoon in Madison, Wisconsin. The rally is part of a coordinated nationwide series of events to march and rally. The following confirmed speakers are Chris Taylor. She's emceeing, and she's from the Wisconsin Assembly. Mark Pocan, who is a candidate for Congress. Kelda Helen Royce, who is also a candidate for Congress. Our very own Yuri Rashkin, who is on the Janesville City Council and a candidate for the Assembly. And, of course, the Rangy Grannies and much more. To learn more about the Wisconsin Unite Women, go to www.unitewomenwi.org. Again, it's www.unitewomenwi.org. And I'd like to welcome Yuri Rashkin to the show. Good morning, Yuri.
Good morning, Sarah. How are you doing this morning?
I am wonderful. And how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. It sounds like you've got an awesome show lined up.
Thank you. I try. It works. I've been trying to get Lisa on for a couple of weeks now. She's a very busy person, so I'm really excited to have her on today. And of course, Rob Zerban and Mayor Barrett. And it's going to be fun.
Awesome. Well, drum roll, please. We're going to get into the news. Our very own Janesville's own Paul Ryan is under fire from the powerful U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops for writing a budget that cuts deeply into programs to help the needy. And, well, Paul Ryan, Representative Ryan, hit back at Georgetown University on Thursday. He said, "I suppose there are some Catholics who for a long time have thought that they had a monopoly of sorts, not exactly on heaven, but on the social teaching of our church. Of course, there can be differences among faithful Catholics on this." So, there goes Paul Ryan. In a war against the Catholic Church. You know, I am not getting in the middle of that one, and I don't think anybody wants. That is, that's excitement that the rest of us can stand back and watch, because if the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is going to be on one side and Paul Ryan is going to be on the other, whoa. Evidently, he managed to touch a nerve.
Well, I didn't realize that because he's a U.S. congressman, he's also able to speak on the theological teachings of the Catholic Church.
Paul Ryan can do anything, Sarah. He can also change his opinion about his idol, Ayn Rand, who used to be the greatest thing since sliced bread, but now he rejects her atheist ideology or philosophy. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I wonder if that's just a way to get in back in with the bishops.
Okay. It's entirely, you know, so much of this is just talking and using the right words, I think, as far as Paul Ryan is concerned, that, you know, I don't know about his relationship with Catholic bishops and their conference, but he just touched a nerve. It's really interesting that you cut, and sooner or later, even churches are going to say, wait a minute. This is not what we're supporting. Well, yes, nobody likes government getting into their business and all of that kind of rhetoric, but when we're getting down to dollars and cents, and we're talking about a lot of dollars and cents here, it's interesting to see that the conference, and there's probably other organizations, that are standing up and saying, no, we do not support this. So let's see how this news story continues to develop.
Does he mention anything about Ayn Rand's fascination with serial killers? Does he manage to?
No, somehow that didn't come up. It really, you know, yeah, no, he didn't talk about it. But he did say that, simply put, I do not believe the preferential option for the poor means the preferential option for big government. Those unwilling to lift the debt are complicit in our acceleration toward a debt crisis in which the poor will be hurt the first and the worst. It's that usual rhetoric about how we're going to protect our future, or are we going to protect the poor by destroying what we have now. It's a very interesting rhetorical spin that you see Republicans use over and over, where we have to protect our children and grandchildren by making ourselves, you know, to taking away all the programs now, even though that puts in real jeopardy our future, that it doesn't really matter. Everything for the rhetoric. Moving on, because we have so much to cover this morning. We have Wisconsin has the worst job loss rate in the last year, as Scott Walker prepares for recall election headline. And it's been all over the news. It's been front page coverage. And how can you ignore the fact that out of 50 states, we're number 50, and or number one from the bottom, depending on how you look at it. I would imagine probably with Walker, it's going to be we're number one. We are the worst, because according to a recent government report, the state has lost 23,900 jobs between March 2011 and March 2012. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that out of those jobs, 17,800 were from private sector and 6,100 were in the private, public were 17,000 and private were 6,100.
And just for the record, where does Illinois fall on that? Do we know?
Well, they are clearly not 50. No, I do not know where Illinois falls on that, but evidently only Mississippi and Rhode Island saw that kind of private sector job loss over the same one-year span. This is something that I guess I've been saying for a while, and I'm sure I'm not alone, which is it's not just, you know, he's hurting state in all sorts of ways, but his policies that he's doing, that he claims are working, don't work. This whole rollover for business and destroy your state, it doesn't work.
And I do like his spin, and I'll tell you why I asked about Illinois in a second, but I do like his spin of, well, the climate is so unsure because of the protests, so no one wants to come in. Well, that's great. If you want to use that, that worked for about 3 months. What about the rest of the time? And, you know, and I know at this point he's saying, oh, look, it's a recall, so the climate is all unsure and no one wants to come in. It's a very interesting spin that he puts onto this. And I'm pretty sure it's not as much with the recall as it is the fact that he's gutted the things that businesses look for, like, you know, education and nice towns to come into and national force and resources and stuff that they can bring their people to. And when you start gutting all this stuff, all of a sudden there's not a lot that Wisconsin offers.
Well, and, you know, to go back to my favorite arsonist metaphor, for the arsonist to complain that all of these fire trucks up and down the street are disrupting regular business, well, dude, why'd you set the house on fire? That probably would have not brought out the firefighters. So I'm sorry, you know, to blame the protesters when you're the one who's causing the havoc, it's again, it's rhetoric, it's politics, and it doesn't really help anybody except that to reassure the people that like you already, I guess, that they should support you. And we'll see where that goes, because the state is, what are the numbers, latest numbers, that it's 47% for, 47% against the recall. And so the fight is over the 6% of the undecided, which are the undecided. So really, actually, half of that, because you need to win over 50%, and then, of course, for the turnout. So we'll see. But the polling numbers are pretty good, at least in terms of retaking the Senate. We have Democrat John Lehman leading Republican Senator Van Wongard in 21st District by a 51-47 margin. And Democrat Kristen Dexter is trailing Republican Senator Terry Moulton 49-47, but we don't need too much. We just need, you know, one seat. So let's see where this goes. I think the Senate is looking very promising, although Republicans, I think, are optimistic about what they might be able to do in the regular November election. But every election is very, very important because you may not be able to win everything, but you can sure lose a lot. So you got to keep trying.
As we've seen in Wisconsin, if you lose a lot, you can really lose a lot, hence why we're 50th in the nation in job creation. And by the way, Illinois is ranked third in the nation in job creation, and I wanted to get back to that real fast because Walker went down there and talked about how wonderful Wisconsin was doing and how Wisconsin should be like Illinois.
It's this entire Fox News approach where facts don't really matter. You just present the information that you want. You spin it with the bright colors and nice music. And those people that want to believe you go, look, see, this is exactly the channel and the person I want to listen to. Facts are up for grabs. It's pretty ridiculous. But I think that front page headlines over and over that we're the 50th in job creation. And frankly, Illinois is number three. I think numbers speak for themselves, so hopefully enough people will listen where we'll be able to get Walker out of there in just at least 39 days now.
That would be a boon to Wisconsin.
I think it would be a real boon to the economy for sure. So now we need to cut back and cover a little more news because we have an excellent email from one of the protest candidates because there's all these protest fake Democrats floating around all over the place. And here's an email that's been floating around from Isaac Weichs, who is running as a protest candidate in a Democratic primary for lieutenant governor. And here's what he says. Because each recall primary is a separate election event, voters may still cross parties in the recall primary, but they may only vote once per office. For example, in the governor's primary, you may only vote for one person, and there's either Republican or Democrat, and there are Democratic primaries for lieutenant governor and state senate. That means that after you vote for Walker in his primary, you can then cross party lines and vote for the Democrat for lieutenant governor and senate. And this is where this Mr. Weichs is promoting his candidacy, saying that he wants to cause havoc and let send the libs a message in the primary. What is he trying to do? He's trying to cause trouble for Malin Mitchell, who is really the only legitimate candidate, and we're really, if we're going to say, you know, the name of the protest candidate, we really have to explain who he's protesting. He's protesting Malin Mitchell. Now, there's an interesting, almost a parlor game possibility here because let's say Malin Mitchell beats Rebecca Clayfish in the recall, as he very well might. I think lots of people know Malin now, and then he's a great guy. Why not? And Rebecca Clayfish, well, we know her. And then let's say that Walker somehow magically remains the governor, but gets indicted. And then he has to resign, and Malin becomes the governor. See, it's very important in that, under various circumstances, to continue to think that we have to have the right person in a lieutenant governor's seat, because this is more important now than possibly ever. So, Malin Mitchell.
And if you want to know who the fake Democrats are, there's a website called Fake Dems Are Us, and it's fakedemsareus.com. And R is just the letter R and then us. And it just lists all the fake Democrats' names so you know who are the fake Dems in this race.
I think that's a very important message, and that's FAKEDEMSRUS.com.
Yes, that's correct.
All right. Yeah, sometimes with websites, it doesn't hurt to get them out more than once because because it's like Toys R Us. What? All right. So we have the protest candidates. We have Chris Christie, who is coming to Wisconsin to campaign with Scott Walker. Who is Chris Christie? Well, he is that charming, obnoxious governor of New Jersey who is going to be campaigning with our not charming and obnoxious Scott Walker. He often dubbed one of the rock stars of the Republican Party, as I guess is Scott Walker now. He's headed next to Wisconsin. The May 1 visit to Green Bay and Milwaukee comes about 1 month before the Republican governor will try to retain his seat.
Well, everybody, in New Jersey should be really happy about that, because if Walker gets indicted, that's something that's going to hang around Chris Christie's neck when he runs again. Yeah, he hangs out with criminals in Wisconsin. So I'm sure that everyone in New Jersey is going, yes, get out there. Go hold hands and skip or whatever together. So they have a lot of photo ops where they can put them together on that.
Oh, these two guys who are not, you know, it's an interesting pattern. As their numbers go down, approval numbers go down in their own states, they start to travel more and more nationwide, because nationally the Republicans still like them. So they become these rock stars everywhere except their own home. It's an interesting consistency there, but we'll see where that goes. Hopefully, maybe Scott Walker and Chris Christie can both retire and go on a rock tour and make music, beautiful music together. I don't know.
Or as Walker says, he's going to really make some money on in the private sector. Yuri, I'm going to put you on hold. We got to go to a break. So,
sure.
You are listening to the Sarah Schultz Show. We're speaking with Yuri Rashkin from Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. I don't buy the condescending denials from industry and government over the mad cow out in California. Oh, everything's fine. Don't bother your little heads about it. That's what the USDA said, and the Cattlemen's Association said, and the corporate media said. But wait a second. How are they so sure? After all, the USDA tests only 40,000 cows a year that are slaughtered. That's less than 0.1% of the total. Not exactly a reassuring sample size. And then there's the really unbelievable part, which is the USDA actually prohibits private companies from testing their own herds. Under pressure from big cattle, they don't want private firms to advertise that their beef is mad cow free, lest consumers start to worry about the safety of other beef. And finally, the USDA hasn't totally outlawed the practice that causes mad cow, which is cannibalism, the feeding of cow meat to cows. It's illegal to do that directly now in this country, but the indirect route is still open and being used. Beef products are being fed to pigs and chickens, and then those pigs and chickens are slaughtered and fed back to cows. My advice to you is, eat less beef, don't buy prefabbed hamburger patties, don't eat hamburgers at restaurants unless you see them making their own, and don't buy beef except from an organic farmer. Finally, don't listen to the USDA when they say not to worry. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Yuri Rashkin from Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup. So what are some of the other news stories this week, Yuri?
Well, continuing with Walker being an out-of-state rock star and in-state about to lose recall, we have a key element of Scott Walker's recall defense is that he's fighting for that out-of-state money. Well, 14 of Walker's top 20 donors are from outside Wisconsin, according to an analysis by the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. 9 people gave $100,000 or more, including Wyoming Republican Foster Freeze, who heavily backed Rick Santorum's presidential campaign. And so we have a governor who is really more interested in being a national figure than he is being in Wisconsin governor. And this is something that Tom Barrett, I believe, brought up more than once, saying that he, instead of creating jobs, he decided to wage an ideological war, which he was quite successful at. It just didn't create any jobs.
But he makes you think that he did.
That's right. He clouds man's mind like shadow.
Or the Jedi mind. These aren't the droids you're looking for. Do we know who the in-state large contributors are by chance? Does he have any in-state? I was going to say, I'm sure he's got some in-state contributors. I know Uline was a big one. They donated over $200,000 in the recall and a couple other ones, but I'm not sure who all else would be the in-state. He's definitely getting much more out-of-state money, and he's been doing that for months. They've been, was in January, I think it was, maybe it was even December, people were talking about getting stuff in Virginia.
Yeah. Yep. That's our governor.
And he continues. I mean, Ed Schultz on the Ed Show last night had another thing about some people in New York got something from him.
Yep. And, well, you know, this is, I think at this point it becomes more about details, because we know that the money is predominantly going to come from out of state because, frankly, there isn't that much in state. So he's getting a lot of money from national donors. And how much exactly he's going to get? Well, probably enough to buy every TV commercial in the state for the last few weeks before the election. That was something interesting because I was present at a little pep talk that Mike Tate, the chair of the Democratic Party, was doing at our local Dems office here in Janesville. And people are concerned because they're hearing from their relatives in Green Bay or whatever, saying that, oh my gosh, the Dems are being, like, they're being obliterated. It's all about Walker, how great he is on TV. And, you know, his response, of course, is that, well, people's minds are made up and there isn't much TV can do. But I think at the same time, personally, it seems to me that Dems, Democrats ourselves, we want to see our commercials up on the air, almost reassuring us that our forces are still out there battling because the war is being waged over the airwaves. So hopefully there will be more ads, and if you feel like there should be more ads, you should contribute to your candidates, your local party, whatever, national party, state party, just, you know, the money needs to go where, you know, it's going to be spent in Wisconsin. But at the same time, the rest is details, and hopefully the best thing to do, frankly, is just to read and to get ourselves educated. But again, how many undecideds are there? So maybe talk to people and find out if they're who they're going to vote for and what their plans are. And that brings us probably to the last issue today, which is education, which is expected to be a major issue in the recall election. The governor keeps cutting money from education, and he just doesn't like stopping. His first budget cut $792 million, or 7%, in state aid for K-12 schools. And, of course, the school districts face an even steeper $1.6 billion net reduction in funding because Walker's budget slashed the amount of money school districts could legally raise from property taxes. And then it gets back to the rhetoric, because if everyone's going to scream about property taxes and how we don't want to raise a penny for property taxes, well, I guess that means we have to destroy our schools. And that choice becomes, this is a false choice anyway, because there's lots of other ways and we can adjust our budget. But when the district's ability to raise funds is limited, this is what we're looking at.
Well, and people forget, too, that we're talking about the children in the classroom and the teachers and the lack of money the teachers are getting. There's also this budget to keep the school functional. It's like building problems. If a roof needs to be repaired, if there's flooding that goes on, if there's other things that go on in the school building, then the school budgets cover that kind of expense. And when you have these cuts to these things, now they've cut out, and a lot of school districts, I don't know if all of them have, but what's one of the things that's going to go is going to be the building expense. So now you're going to look at schools that maybe 2 years from now are going to need a roof, and there's going to be no money for the roof. Or any kind of upgrades that have to happen to the school building itself, we're going to start seeing those things kind of fall to the wayside. So it's not just the kids in the classroom, and it's not just the teacher's pay.
But you know that the priority is to create a playing field that allows private schools to compete and charter schools to compete effectively. And we know that that's not going to work, but at the same time, if you're going to keep taking money away from education, at what point people are going to stop choosing Wisconsin as the place to live?
That's right. Well, Yuri, thank you so much. I know you've got to run off, and I just want to thank you for being on the show today.
Hey, thanks very much, and I look forward to speaking at the rally tomorrow. It's going to be awesome. I hope everyone comes out.
Oh, it's going to be great. I can't wait to hear you.
Thanks very much. You take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Yuri Raskin with Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup. Now, we have a break coming up in a short while, but I want to get to Rob Zurbon. Rob Zurbon is running against Paul Ryan in the 1st Congressional District in the state of Wisconsin. So, good morning, Rob.
Good morning, Sarah. How are you doing today?
I am doing well. How are you?
Great. Great. It's a beautiful day in here in Wisconsin, and campaign's rolling along. Everything's going wonderfully.
Wonderful. And I want to say thank you so much for being on the show today. I know you're a very busy person. It's very hard to get you pinned down, so thank you so much.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, Paul Ryan released a budget that looks very similar to something we already have seen in Wisconsin, which is basically Walker's budget. Do you feel that this budget represents what the majority of people need in the first congressional district?
No, absolutely not. You know, like we've seen here in Wisconsin, you know, Paul Ryan's pushing at the federal level what Scott Walker has been doing here at the state level, and we've seen that these are absolutely the wrong ideas for the state. We, you know, because of Walker's extreme agenda, we've been having job losses when the rest of the country has been adding jobs in the states. Wisconsin is still losing jobs. So we get a clear sense of what would happen if Paul Ryan and the GOP were allowed to proceed with this kind of a out-of-touch budget at a federal level. So we know it's the wrong direction for Wisconsin and it's the wrong direction for the country.
Well, in your opinion, what's the first thing that needs to happen in the first congressional district to help bring jobs back into this area?
Well, you know, we reached out to the counties that are part of the first congressional district and asked them what's most important to you, because we want to have a kind of campaign that listens to the people of the first congressional district, and that's the kind of representation I want to provide. So when we reached out to the people of the first congressional district and we were getting the feedback, the things that were most important to them, the first thing was actually getting the money out of our political process. The second thing was jobs. And the third thing was protecting Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security and the social safety nets that we rely on. So I think these kind of all go hand in hand, because once you get the money out of politics, you can start to actually focus on doing the people's business, which is making sure that we have good jobs in the first congressional district by having practical legislation that would be attractive to companies to bring the manufacturing back to the state. And then we don't have the influence of big money politicians like the Koch brothers trying to just reduce their tax burden and trying to do that by getting rid of Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid, things that they've never stood for and have always been opposed to, like the rest of the GOP. So I think it's a combination of these things all kind of working hand in hand. But you know what? You know, I love what Tammy Baldwin says when she says, if you put the workers in the United States against any worker in the world, the United States worker will win. But you got to give them the opportunity. You got to level the playing field. And that's why we need to make sure that we have trade deals that are actually fair trade deals as opposed to free trade deals that put the American worker at a disadvantage. You know, a lot of these countries that we've been having trade agreements with, they don't have the same environmental standards. They don't have the same kind of protection for their workers in the workplace, cutting corners and reducing costs that are very dangerous to the workers. And so we need to make sure that when the American worker has the ability to compete, it's done on a fair level playing field. And you know, we will win every time when that's possible, when that happens.
What kind of fair trade would you be looking at to do? Because we have a lot of – I know President Obama just signed a couple more free trade agreements. We have, of course, NAFTA. So what kind of fair trade system would you bring in?
Well, we can't enter into agreements where countries that are trying to organize their workers regularly assassinate their labor leaders, like in Colombia. You know, the human rights aspect of the working conditions for employees, it must be universal. And we can't start working with countries and trading with countries who don't adhere to minimum standards of safety for their employees, the ability to organize, to make sure that to collectively bargain. These are the kind of things that need to happen universally so that we can promote the human condition for everybody around the world. And the United States has been a leader in that. And unfortunately, corporations, as they become multinational and bigger and you know, too big to fail, have been able to exploit the workers and take advantage of workforces in other countries, and that's why we're losing jobs. So we need to make sure that if corporations are going to be moving their production overseas, that if they're an American company, that they're paying a penalty and don't have the incentive to do that. So I think that gives you a little bit clearer picture of where I stand on trying to make sure that we can bring manufacturing back to the states and here in the state of Wisconsin, because these corporations are taking advantage of people who don't have a strong voice, and here in the United States they do. So we need to make sure that Everybody around the world has a strong voice because, you know, as we all know, rising tides lift all boats. So that's where we have an obligation as representatives to make sure that that's the case.
Okay, we're going to go to a quick break here. So can you hold on for a few minutes?
Absolutely.
Okay. We are speaking with Rob Zerban. He is running against Paul Ryan in the 1st Congressional District, and you're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz. And we'll be right back with Rob. If you have any questions for him, you can call him at 877-497-1797. Welcome back to the Sarah Schultz Show. Sarah Schultz, and we're speaking with Rob Zerban, who is running against Paul Ryan in the 1st Congressional District. Now, he has Paul Ryan has been dubbed kind of a budget guru. You know, Romney said it was a marvelous budget and how wonderful it is, and Paul Ryan's all concerned about fiscal responsibility, yet he went and voted for wars, he voted for Medicare Part D. None of these were even in the budget under the Bush years, let alone a way to get this paid for. So this is an interesting sort of a flip-flop for him, where he started, where now all of a sudden it's fiscal responsibility, whereas before he's like, oh, well, yeah, I'll vote for that. That sounds good. I don't know how we'll pay for it. We'll figure it out.
Yeah, he's got a lot to answer for. 14 years of bad judgment, pushing for policies that were not consistent with what people of the 1st Congressional District would like to see. You know, he always would come into the district and talk a very mild game, but then when he'd fly into Washington, D.C., he'd become one of the most partisan legislators out there. So, yes, he did support the two unfunded wars. He supported and voted for all the Bush tax cuts, and then also the largest expansion of Medicare, which was Medicare Part D, which was also unfunded, and turned out to be just a big gift to Big Pharma. You know, that's when the GOP gave up the government's fundamental right to negotiate for the price of prescription drugs. And why in the world would you ever give the largest purchaser of prescription drugs, why would you give up your right to negotiate for them? So, yes, Medicare Part D costs a third more than the veterans drug benefit, and this is just ridiculous. You know, he votes along with these irresponsible policies, and, you know, during the time when Dick Cheney is saying deficits don't matter, and then all of a sudden we go through the toughest financial crisis since the Great Depression. We have a Democratic president, Barack Obama, and then all of a sudden Paul Ryan saying, look, I'm Mr. Fiscally Responsible, and we know this is absolutely not the truth. So the people are finally seeing through his rhetoric and understand that he's not on the side of the people, but of big business and big industries, you know, insurance companies and oil and gas companies fighting to keep $40 billion in subsidies in the budget for them on an annual basis. And in his budget, you know, adds $4.7 trillion to the debt over the next 10 years. So, you know, You can say one thing and do another, but people are eventually going to see the truth and realize that you don't have their best interest in mind.
Well, you said 14 years. He was the congressman for 14 years. Would you say that qualifies him as a career politician?
Oh, that's the 14 years he was actually elected to be a representative. Before that, he had worked for, and you know, he graduated from college with a bachelor's degree, I think, in economics and in political science, and he went off to Washington, D.C. and started working for Senator Bob Casten. And then once Russ Feingold beat him in the election, Paul Ryan then went to work for, I believe it was Jack Kemp, and being a speechwriter. And then he worked for some conservative think tank while he was out there, and only came back to the 1st Congressional District and lived in the district to run for office eventually. So his whole adult life, his whole working career has been inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C. So, yes, I think he definitely qualifies as a career politician, an out-of-touch Washington insider who only listens to K Street and Wall Street and not to Main Street.
You mentioned, we were talking about jobs in the first CD, the first congressional district. You mentioned something about manufacturing. Do you know the state of manufacturing in Wisconsin, if there are pockets of development for manufacturing, especially in the first CD?
I'm sorry, are there pockets of development for manufacturing? I'm not sure what you're exactly trying to...
All right, well, what is the state of manufacturing in Wisconsin right now?
We are in desperate need of manufacturing jobs. We've seen, you know, there are companies who are not making investment in Wisconsin because, frankly, you know, Governor Walker has made it a banana republic up here. And we need to correct the situation by getting a new governor elected in the recall election on June 8th and make sure that we can move the state forward again, stopping the exodus of jobs from the state, getting people to make investments. A friend of mine works for, I can't remember the name of the wind energy company that had walked away from several millions of dollars of investment in Wisconsin because they were uncertain respect to the economic climate and the political environment. So, you know, if you destabilize a state the way that Scott Walker and the Republicans have done, this is what happens. You know, pushing ideological agendas as opposed to jobs agendas and keeping out your concern for the economic well-being of the state and just trying to push programs, unpopular programs through that hurt the state, this is what happens. So there are a lot of things we can do once we get a new administration and a new Senate that would help bring jobs back to the state. And I do think there's a lot of opportunity. You know, if there's one area that I disagree with President Obama on is that there was not enough of a push to make sure that we have good renewable energy programs being developed and green technology to move the U.S. economy into the next 100 years of a world economy. Because, look, if you're not leading the world, in green jobs and renewable energies, you're following somebody else. So we're missing a huge economic opportunity in the state of Wisconsin, in our country as a whole, by not making an investment in our future, not educating our young adults to be competitive and leaders in these kind of technologies, because somebody is going to fill that void. And if it's not the United States, we're making a big mistake.
Well, where does Paul Ryan sit on green energy and that kind of job creation? Because I know you are for that type of job creation.
Mm-hmm. You know, I sat on the board of directors for the Wisconsin League of Conservation Voters. I got involved in my community, advocating for the Great Lakes Compact, going door-to-door canvassing, making sure people understood why we needed to protect the Great Lakes and our freshwater drinking supply. You know, I can't tell you Paul Ryan's position on it, other than, you know, I know he's a big fan of oil and gas, and I'm sure that, you know, if we look through his donations, there's going to be a lot of money there from those companies, and he's a good friend of the Koch brothers, so who are heavily invested in oil and gas. You know, he was totally in favor of killing the high-speed rail between Milwaukee and Madison. It's, what does he call it, welfare when people have public transportation. And he voted to open the Great Lakes to oil and gas exploration along with sensitive areas of the Everglades down in Florida. So we know that he is a pro-drill, pro-ruin the environment kind of politician. And most of the people, I think as high as like 97 or 98% of people, don't want to see drilling on the Great Lakes because they understand how important it is to keep these Great Lakes pristine and fresh and be an economic engine for the upper Midwest that we all rely on these lakes. So there's definitely enough there in his voting history to show that he's not in favor of moving our economy off the petro economy towards a new green economy, and that's exactly what we need to be doing.
Do you feel that that's the way to bring manufacturing back to the First City? Because it was a huge manufacturing area. A lot of them left, including the two plants of Kenosha and Janesville. Do you feel that instead of trying to bring back the plants from the car companies, do you feel that we might have a better chance, or the First CD, I live in the First CD, so I mentioned we, that the First CD would have a better chance with a green manufacturing base?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. I mean, the First Congressional District has a really great history with respect to the auto industry, and it's the first time in over 100 years we haven't had a plant and being, you know, affiliated with the auto industry, and I would really like to see those come back, and I think a lot of people here would too. But I think it's a combination. You know, they're not going to stop producing cars, and we need to make sure that if there's an opportunity for them to bring the production back, that we do that. And I'm trying to think of different ways that we can entice, you know, maybe even foreign motor companies to come back into the first or start production here in the First Congressional District. Because a lot of auto manufacturers are shipping their cars from overseas to here, and if they don't have to incur that shipping cost and can do the production here, I'm sure that can be a cost savings to that company. So there's various things I'd like to look at. We are becoming more of a global economy and a world market in that way, and it is very attractive to other companies to do production here if they're shipping into the United States. So I plan on taking a look at that and how we can incentivize corporations to make that investment. You know, obviously with it being a private entity, Chrysler plant or the GM plant, there is a role for elected leadership to help facilitate these kind of conversations, and we don't see Paul Ryan doing enough of that. You know, I think he's focusing more on his national profile and trying to elevate his profile to for whatever reason. I think he has higher ambitions, but he can't forget where he came from, and he's certainly been doing that and not been focusing on the people of the First Congressional District and bringing those jobs back, which we know are so important, and not making the investment into the new green economy that's going to be there with renewable energies. And that's what I would like to do as a representative. I would like to focus on a solution to these problems and, you know, start these conversations and figure out how we can work together to get those jobs back in the first CD.
Would you be opposed to going to different car companies if we can't get those back? Would you be opposed to getting to maybe Fiat or Cooper or going to talk to other ones just to bring something back to the first CD?
Absolutely. I think there are I do know for a fact that an auto company like Audi, based in Germany, actually exports more Audis than they actually sell inside Germany now. And so, and a fair amount of those cars are coming to the United States and Canada and Mexico. So if there's a company like that out there that, you know, would be interested in having a base of production here in the United States, let's talk to them. Let's see if we can't kind of help broker a deal to make sure that these plants are not sitting idle and people are, you know, unemployed.
If people want more information about you on your campaign, where would you send them to? Where would you like them to go?
Well, they can check out our website. It's my name, Rob, R-O-B, Zerban, Z-E-R-B-A-N, .com. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The office is located in downtown Kenosha. We have offices in Janesville and Racine. And all this information is available on the website, robzerban.com, R-O-B-Z-E-R-B-A-N.com.
Well, Rob, thank you so much for being on the show today. I appreciate it. We'll have to definitely get you on again.
I would love the opportunity. Thank you so much for having me today.
Oh, you're welcome. Good luck in your campaign, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Sarah. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Rob Zerban, who was running against Paul Ryan in the 1st Congressional District, or 1st CD, as we call it. And we're going to take a quick break, and coming up next is going to be Michelle Doolin and Anna Conkle on the We Are Women March going on tomorrow in Madison.
My congratulations to workers in 16 states, from Maine to Georgia, New Jersey to Colorado. Many of you will be thrilled to know that the income taxes deducted from your paychecks each month are going to a very worthy cause, your corporate boss. Good Jobs First, a nonprofit, nonpartisan research center, has analyzed state programs meant to create jobs, but instead have created some $700 million a year in corporate welfare. This scam starts with a normal practice of corporations withholding from each employee's monthly check the state income taxes their workers owe. But rather than remitting this money to pay for state services, these 16 states simply allow the corporations to keep the tax payments for themselves. Adding to the funkiness of taxation by corporation, the bosses don't even have to tell workers that the company is siphoning off their state taxes for its own fun and profit. These heists are rationalized in the name of job creation, but that's a hoax too. They're really just bribes the states pay to get corporations to move existing jobs from one state to another, or they're hostage payments to corporations that demand the public's money, or else they'll move their jobs out of state. Last year, Kansas used workers withholding taxes to bribe AMC Entertainment with a $47 million payment to move its headquarters from downtown Kansas City, Missouri, to a KC suburb on the Kansas side, just 10 miles away. What a ripoff. Among the 2,700 corporations cashing in on such absurd diversions of state taxes from public need to private greed are Goldman Sachs, GE, Motorola, and Procter & Gamble. This is Jim Hightower saying, for ways you can help stop this despicable giveaway, get the full report. It's available at goodjobsfirst.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz, and we are speaking with Michelle Doolin and Edna Conkle about the We Are Women March in Madison tomorrow afternoon. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Well, thank you for having one of us back and letting Michelle come in and join the mix.
Oh, absolutely. It's a lot of fun to talk with you. I had a great time talking with you last week, Edna. And I feel that this is just a really important thing that we, especially we as women, need to be aware of and need to be there for and need to support. Because if we don't support it, really, who else is going to do that for us?
you know, I want to think of that as a rhetorical question, but, you know, it is our responsibility to step up and get out there.
Now, the march is set for tomorrow afternoon at 1 p.m. in Madison. Can you go into a little bit of details of when and where and some of the breakdowns of what's going on?
Sure. When we're starting at approximately 12:55, we want people to gather early enough to get there. It is Crazy Legs Day and Farmers Market Day, so do what you can to arrange parking and that kind of stuff. When I finish my spiel here, I'll toss it over to Michelle to talk a little bit about parking and shuttle bus services. But basically, we're going to be starting at about 12:55 with some music from the Pipers, and then we're going to go right into a program. We've got a bunch of speakers to speak for the day. We've got Chris Taylor, an assemblywoman, who will be our MC for the day. We've got, and I'm giving you people in order here, so also assemblyperson Joe Casta Zamaripa, or Joey Z. Then we've got Dee Ives, who's an Air Force veteran nurse, who's going to be talking about what happened to her party. Mark Pocan, also an assembly person and a candidate for Congress. Kathy Utley, who is the Goodman Community Center in Madison's food resources manager. Yuri Rashkin from Janesville, who's a candidate for assembly and former, recently completed two terms as a Janesville City Council member. Sarah Finger, who's an awesome spokesperson for Wisconsin Women's Health as the executive director of Wisconsin Alliance for Women's Health. Then we'll have a little bit of a break. This should be somewhere close to 2 o'clock where we'll have the Raging Grannies on stage doing some music for us. And then we'll come back to the program with Ruth Conniff, a writer for The Progressive, Tiffany Keo from Sun Prairie, who's involved in children's programs, and we'll be talking about dealing with the concepts of community and how to get diverse groups together and talking about issues. We've got Rob Zerban, whose name I didn't know how to pronounce last week, but since he was just on, I probably should do that correctly, who's also a candidate for Congress. We've got Kelda Helen Royes, who another candidate for Congress and a current Wisconsin Assemblywoman. Reverend Stephen Welsh from the Wisconsin Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. Gwen Carr, a Native American activist and matriarch. And John Nichols, who is a political blogger and Washington correspondent for The Nation, who will be our keynote speaker. And then there'll be some messages from people who can't be at the event, a few personal stories of women who have been affected by the war on women. And, we'll do what we can to get the message out there. And to get people to and from the event, we recently added a shuttle bus and some services so that because the inner loop will be closed, the square will be closed to traffic due to Crazy Legs, we wanted to make sure that we could get people to the event. So I'm hoping that Michelle can chime in on this one.
Yes, there's going to be a shuttle service that will be available from 12 p.m. to 4 p.m. and running every 15, 20 minutes. The shuttle will run from the Fiore Shopping Center, which is located at 1860 East Washington Avenue, to the corner of Wilson and Martin Luther King Boulevard. There's plenty of free parking in the shopping center lot and the side streets and the Burr Jones Field, so that shouldn't be a problem. So if you're afraid of approaching the square, that would be a great place to park. There's plenty of the bus will be running every 15, 20 minutes, so that'll make it easy. And we're asking for a nominal donation of about $1 for to help offset the cost of the shuttle service. We want to provide something really affordable and easy to get to, because sometimes buses themselves can be daunting. Do you want me to say parking?
Well, hold that thought for a second. Do you have any buses coming in from out of town, or does everyone have to get to Madison, then you'll shell them once they get to Madison?
We have a couple of buses coming in from out of town, and we also have one of the women in our volunteer group named Kelly Herta kind of rallied up a minivan brigade. So people who are coming in from remote areas of from areas outside of Madison, they're not necessarily remote, but they're further away than some people, are trying to fill up as many minivans as possible, and so they're going to be coming in and trying to park in in easily accessible areas rather than actually bringing a lot of physical chartered buses into the area. We figure most people were coming anyway and might as well, you know, share the cost of gas and meet up with some new friends and come in that way.
Is there any way people can get the information or a contact information or something if they wanted to come in and either didn't have a vehicle or wanted to share some of the gas costs?
You know, the best way to get that information to us is to go to our, let's see, what is the best way? Go to our website, which is unitewomenwi.org. Click the community page and post a message up there. It's a Facebook community page. Or click the Remind Me link on the homepage of the website and send a message that, you know, an urgent message that I need transportation. There's a form that they can fill out that will collect their email address, and so we can get back to them that way. So even if they're not on Facebook, we have a way of communicating with them.
Okay. And Michelle, can you go in about parking? We've got about 2 minutes left, so can you go in a little bit about parking?
Sure. There is parking in the area, especially if you plan ahead and are planning on doing farmers market or anything else. Monona Terrace parking is available for the day of our event, and it's just blocks from the rally. They charge $4 a day on weekends. This lot will fill up fast, so plan ahead if you plan to park there. Definitely arrive early. Also, bus routes. If you want to take the city bus, the easiest way is to catch one from Easttown Mall, which is right off I-90. Parking is available, and the Route 6 bus will take you to the Capitol, and that ride is about 40 minutes. Also, if you want to hit the best bus turn right off the Capitol Square, parking is nice there because it's valet service, and they're quite nice. And if you wanted to call ahead, the number is 608-285-8000 and ask if they expect their parking to be open, considering the number of events.
Okay, and you said the shuttle bus, if people want to drive in, the shuttle bus is from what shopping center?
It's from the Fiore Shopping Center, which is 1860 East Washington Avenue. We picked there instead of Easttown Mall because we can offer quicker shuttle service that way, because it's about a 6-minute drive from there as opposed to way out at Easttown Mall.
And that'll be from 12 to 4 p.m.?
Right, yeah.
Okay. Is there anything else you guys wanted to add real fast?
We just want to make sure that people are bringing all their friends who care about the women in their lives, because we feel that this is important for everybody. And it, you know, anything that affects women actually affects everybody. So it's not just women's rights. This is human rights, and it's a great way to express your concerns about where the country is and where we're going.
And where do you meet again? You meet in by the Capitol on, is it West Franklin?
We will be on the South Hamilton Street side of the Capitol. It is the flattest area. There's only 3 stairs on that sidewalk, so we'll be building a stage and making sure that people can hear us with a good sound system.
Okay. Well, Michelle and Edna, thank you so much for being on today. I appreciate it. And good luck tomorrow with the rally and the march. And I think it's going to be a great time, so if everyone could head on down there, that would be wonderful. I think you've got some phenomenal speakers. You've got a lot of good things going on.
All right. Well, thank you. And, if the weather is anything like it's predicted to be, you might want to bring a coat and protect from water. So
an umbrella. Yeah, a little rain isn't going to make us go away. That's just going to bring out the flowers another month. It's not going to stop us. So,
All right.
All right. Well, thank you so much, guys. Good luck tomorrow. And I don't know if I can make it down there, but I know a lot of people will. And I'm really looking forward to, if I can't be down there, listening to some of the stuff coming up, or hopefully I can, and see you all there.
Thank you.
So,
thank you, Mitch.
You're welcome. We're speaking with Michelle Doolin and Ed LeConco with the We Are Women March in Madison, Wisconsin. And again, the website is www.unitewomen.org. I'm sorry, unitewomenwi.org if you want more information. We're going to go to a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll be speaking with Lisa Graves from the Center for Media and Democracy. We'll be speaking with about Alec and MacGyver Institute, and you're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz. Welcome back to the Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz. Before we bring Lisa Graves on, we have a caller, Sarah, who's got some really interesting information about the We Are Women March. And actually, it's something going on that they're, you know, why don't you talk about it, Sarah?
Hi, everyone. I'm from Janesville. I was just reading an article that was posted yesterday about anti-against war on women groups. And the article is basically stating that they don't want to be violent. They don't want to give the march that we're doing credit. Basically, what they want to do is have pro-lifers go undercover and get photos and videos of the event, basically having those of us attending say, you know, why we're doing this and hoping to catch us uneducated. I think it's really important that when we go to these rallies and we have interviews and moments that we're being questioned about why we do what we do or what we believe, that we're educated enough that we have sources and, you know, we don't look like we're there just to be there. We're there for a purpose. So just everybody be on their toes, I guess, tomorrow and be safe. And, you know, Wisconsin has a great example of for not being, you know, violent and whatnot. So let's promote education and in our opinionated guesses through actual education. So that's kind of what I have to say. Just be on your toes with why you're there and your sources.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. Where did you read that information at? Can you say?
I read it at lifenews.com. The article is called Pro-Abortion Groups Organize Anti-War on Women Rallies.
And they're just in there to try to put stuff up for later. So if you get interviewed then from these people and they put stuff up, and they're trying to make everyone, they're trying to discredit this.
Exactly. The part of the article reads from Eric Scheidler, I guess he's a rally leader. He says, "I don't think it warrants any kind of pro-life counter-protest. That's giving it too much credit," he said. "Rather, I'm encouraging pro-lifers to go undercover and get some photos and videos of the event. I'd love to hear the attendants explain what exactly it is they're doing there uniting against." So,
you know, can't these people get a hobby? But then again, on the same token, it is a free country, and they're welcome to come in and speak
exactly
their mind as well. So just be aware, be on your toes. Let's stay with the nonviolence. And thank you so much for calling in on that, Sarah.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Have a great time tomorrow. Bye.
Thanks. You too, Sarah. So I now am going to get Brendan Fisher. He is on for Lisa Graves, and Brendan is with the Center for Media and Democracy. Good morning, Brendan.
Good morning.
How are you this morning?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Good. Well, thank you so much for being on today. Now, ALEC has come in under a lot of heat as of late. I want to start off, ALEC. I definitely want to spend more time on MacIver because not a lot of people know about that. But they've been getting some news. Do you feel that the corporations that are moving out will affect ALEC? And if they do, how would it?
Certainly. Well, there's a few ways that corporations dropping their ALEC membership is going to affect ALEC. The big way is just with ALEC's funding. ALEC gets 98% of its funding from its corporate donors and from grants from foundations. So without that funding, they really can't advance their agenda. So far, there have been 13 corporations that have announced they are no longer going to be members of ALEC. And this includes really big, big corporations like Coca-Cola, like Procter & Gamble, like McDonald's. And so without these membership dues and without the additional funding that these corporations provide, ALEC will not be able to advance its agenda in the same way that it has for over 30 years. The other part of it is that without these corporations, ALEC can't claim the same level of legitimacy that they had. ALEC is being exposed for what it really is, and that's a far right, highly ideological organization that pushes bills that are just not good for the American people, like the Stand Your Ground laws, like voter ID, like union busting, like anti-immigrant laws.
Do you feel that since ALEC is so well known and these people are pulling out, do you feel the Kochs, the Bradley, and the Bradley Foundation will start another closet foundation and will take up where ALEC left off?
I think that's very possible. I think the Bradley Foundation and the Kochs are not as susceptible to their to public pressure, and they may not be as concerned about their brand as organizations like Coca-Cola or Procter & Gamble are. You know, they're highly motivated to push an ideological agenda, and it's likely that they'll continue funding ALEC, and they're going to continue funding a whole host of other organizations that also advance policies that are in many ways just not good for the American people.
Do you feel that we've seen just the tip of the iceberg of the corporations that are leaving? Do you feel that there's more to come, or do you feel that we've hit the bulk of them and that there might be some that trickle out here and there, but the bulk of them are have gone already?
No, I think this is. I think this will be ongoing. There are between 150 and 200 corporations that are ALEC members, and so far there have only been 13 that have announced they're leaving. And many of the other ALEC members are major corporations that that are concerned about their brand, and they don't necessarily want their brand associated with voter suppression and anti-immigrant sentiment and union busting. State Farm is an ALEC member. You know, they spend millions of dollars each year trying to promote the idea that State Farm is a good neighbor, and they probably don't want their brand to be affected by their association with this extreme organization. Others like Johnson & Johnson, AT&T, these are also corporations that rely on dollars from people across the political spectrum that don't necessarily want their consumer dollars being used to support an organization like ALEC.
Do you have a list of Wisconsin companies that are members of ALEC?
We will be coming out with that relatively soon. On our website, alecexposed.org, there's a link to the list of all known ALEC corporations, and we're in the process of compiling a list that's more specific to Wisconsin.
How about politicians? It can be Wisconsin or non-Wisconsin politicians. Do you see any politicians leaving ALEC? I know some of the Dems have, but do you see that may be something that would also speed up in the near future as well, some of the politicians leaving?
Yeah, there have been a number of politicians leaving and denouncing their ALEC membership. This is from both parties, both Democrats and Republicans. ALEC boasts of having around 2,000 legislative members. Almost all of them are Republican, but there are a few Democrats, mostly conservative Democrats, and some Democrats who maybe just want a free trip to the ALEC conference. But you've been seeing a number of them in states across the country denouncing their ALEC membership, some saying that they didn't know what ALEC was when they got involved, others saying that the organization had changed. It's gotten even more far right and even more reactionary than it was when they joined. And the state chair of ALEC, who had a leadership role in Louisiana, he stepped down last week. So we've been seeing a wave of this happening in Wisconsin. There are, I believe, around 40 or 45 members of ALEC in the state legislature. None of them have announced that they're leaving yet. As we've seen over the past year, though, the Republicans have tended to move in lockstep. So it's unknown whether any of them are going to break with this organization.
Do you think that Wisconsin might be a separate case because a lot of the legislatures have kind of been bought and paid by the Koch brothers. And if anyone wants to look that up, they can go to maplight.com, I believe, or .org and look that up. But other than in Wisconsin where they're locked up, do you feel that there will be more legislators leaving as this goes on, like with the corporations?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I think ALEC is being exposed for what it really is, and it's part of the reason it's been successful for so long is that it's been able to operate in the shadows, that it's allowed corporations and special interest groups like the National Rifle Association to influence legislators to pay for their flights and pay for their hotel rooms and lobby in resorts where everything is paid for. It's given these special interest groups an opportunity to really influence state legislators away from public view in meetings where the press is not allowed, where the public is not allowed. And legislators have, I think they've probably appreciated the free trips and also the opportunity to develop relationships with lobbyists who will then contribute to their campaigns. And now that more light is being shined on the organization, I think many legislators are realizing that just like the corporate members of ALEC, they don't want to be associated with this extreme organization that really facilitates the influence of special interests and corporate interests.
Okay, we're going to go to a quick break. So, Brendan, hold on there. And you're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show, Sarah Schultz. I'm speaking with Brendan Fisher. He is here with the Center for Media and Democracy. We were talking about ALEC. When we come back from a break, we're going to start talking about the MacIver Institute.
Hi, this is Eric Brandt, host of Civil Discourse, a free podcast that you can subscribe to on iTunes. This week, people all over Wisconsin woke up to headlines stating that Wisconsin leads the nation in job losses. We have now lost 23,900 jobs from March of 2011 to March of 2012. As Scott Walker heads into an historic recall election, these numbers could spell disaster for him and his administration. It is awfully hard to convince workers to vote for you after you have deeply divided a state with your attack on collective bargaining, only for the numbers to show that the unions were right to oppose you. Walker says that after the recall election is over, the jobs will explode in Wisconsin. Ironically, Walker said the same thing last summer during the Senate recalls. Remember how many jobs came to Wisconsin when those were finished? Me neither. Walker goes on to tout the fact that unemployment is at its lowest point since 2008 in Wisconsin. The real reason for this is that unemployment numbers are extremely unreliable during times of recession. The unemployment rate does not count those who have stopped looking for work or those whose benefits have run out. Even other Republicans are jumping from the Walker ship, as Republican Senator Robin Voss has called Scott Walker a whack job, and various GOP gubernatorial candidates across the country are running on the line, "I am not Scott Walker." We must unify behind our Democratic candidate after the primary to defeat Scott Walker and bring Wisconsin home. I'm Eric Brandt, host of Civil Discourse, because it's essential for democracy.
You're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show, Sarah Schultz. I'm speaking with Brendan Fisher, who is with the Center for Media and Democracy. And, Brendan, let's go. I want to talk a little bit about the MacIver Institute. Can you actually tell people exactly what they are? Because people have heard of them, but I don't know if people really know who they are.
Yeah, so their full name is the John K. MacIver Institute for Public Policy, and they present themselves as both a think tank and as a journalism outfit. During the Wisconsin protest, they sent some of their camera crews out to the protest to try and, you know, expose just how terrible these protesters were. They released a number of videos that were oftentimes heavily edited to present a negative view of the protesters. And of course, these videos were picked up by the right wing blogosphere. They, you know, reposted on Breitbart's Big Government, other right wing news outlets. And they're an ideological organization that primarily led by people that have close ties to the Republican Party, that have led a number of Republican campaigns. But they're also quoted in the press fairly often, usually being presented as somewhat of a neutral source or as a or as scholars or a think tank. But what they really are is they're pretty ideological. They're closely tied to the Republican Party, and what they're trying to do is advance a political agenda. And most recently, go ahead.
No, please finish.
Sure. So you also may have heard of them because most recently they've teamed up with American for Prosperity. That's the Koch-funded Tea Party group, and they've purchased well over $1 million of ads that have played in Wisconsin that claim that it's working. So they never specifically mention Governor Walker. I think anyone that looks at these ads would understand them to be a campaign advertisement. They're intended to bolster Governor Walker, to try and convince people to vote for him. But they certainly appear to be trying to convince people to vote to allow Governor Walker to stay in office. And this is problematic because both MacIver Institute and Americans for Prosperity are 501c3 charities. So contributions to these groups can be tax deductible. They can be written off on their taxes as charitable deductions. And what they're basically doing is turning around and using these charitable deductions to run campaign ads, and that's a real problem.
Haven't they been turned in yet to anyone, or has there been anything going on because of that?
I believe the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign did write a complaint to the IRS, asking the IRS to investigate what appears to be a violation of the tax code. But with these types of complaints, the IRS is usually pretty slow moving. They don't always fully explain where they are in the process of the investigation or if they're investigating at all. So it's a problem with the IRS, especially during this campaign season, as more and more of these charities are getting involved in political activities and getting involved in political campaigns. It's a real problem because the IRS's enforcement arm is underfunded, it's weak, and it doesn't have the capacity to really fully enforce all of these provisions of the tax code.
What are some of the things that the MacIver Institute has actually done in Wisconsin other than throw out ads and put out papers supporting Walker?
So they have a news site. They do reporting. They do different policy papers, and usually, you know, advancing a conservative agenda, which on its own is, you know, that's okay. We want a marketplace of ideas. It's okay to put different perspectives out there and allow people to judge for themselves. But in the past, they've also used somewhat questionable reporting techniques. We know that one of the reporters in 2009 was charged with obtaining interviews with two elected Wisconsin officials under false pretenses, never disclosed his affiliation with MacIver, and that's just bad journalistic ethics. They were the group that during the protest filmed the doctors who were giving out doctor's notes to teachers, or allegedly giving out doctor's notes to teachers, and there were also irregularities in that video. And they've also been one of the groups that have really been trying to discredit the recall campaign and trying to allege that there's all of these irregularities in the signatures, not really based on any real evidence of there being irregularities, but just to try and discredit the work of tens of thousands of Wisconsin residents.
Do they have, when they cite their studies, where are they getting their studies from? They're backing these types of conservative ideology.
I'm not sure. I think they probably get them from a number of different sources. They probably conduct some of it on their own. Their funding comes from they were founded by the Sam Adams Alliance, which is a Chicago-based conservative group, and the Sam Adams Alliance gets funding from the State Policy Network, which is partially funded by the Claude Lambe Foundation, and that's one of the foundations that are controlled by the Koch brothers. So that's part of the network that they're plugged into.
So not only are they plugged in financially then, but they're also plugged in through studies and other things, so they can show that, for example, Scott Walker's budget is working because they have three or four studies that may show something at somewhere.
Yeah, and I guess I'm not real sure exactly where they who they hire to do their studies or where they get the information from, but they are part of a larger network of conservative groups that are basically trying to advance a political agenda.
Are they linked with ALEC at all?
We don't know that they're linked directly. The State Policy Network, which they are connected to, is an ALEC member, and they're closely associated with ALEC. And MacIver also received some journalists or some support from the Franklin Center for Government and Public Integrity. And the Franklin Center is a group that is an ALEC member and has exhibited at the ALEC conference. And they also try and create kind of right-wing news sites. And MacGyver has received reporters from them, but I don't know that there's a real direct link between MacGyver and Alec.
How about some of the right-wing media outlets in the state, such as radio talk shows, some of the hosts, maybe the Wisconsin Reporter? How connected are they with that?
So Wisconsin Reporter is closely affiliated with the Franklin Center. So there's a number of different, you know, insert state here reporter groups across the country, and they're associated with this Franklin Center for Government and Public Integrity. And what they do is they basically fund and create news sites with investigative reporters to try and dig up dirt and advance a conservative agenda. So they're the group associated with the Franklin Center, like the group you mentioned, the Wisconsin Reporter, are advancing similar goals as MacGyver. And the other issue with that, the issue with the Wisconsin Reporter, is that not only do they put their news stories out on their website, they're also picked up as a wire service. So these articles are highly ideological. They're intended to advance a political agenda, which on its own, you know, like I said, marketplace of ideas, it's okay to put those ideas out there, as long as people know the source and know where they're coming from. But with Wisconsin Reporter, these stories are picked up by small newspapers across the state and reprinted, usually without any indication that the source of the article is this highly ideological group. They're printed as if they were just a story from the AP or from Reuters, and the story is written with the intent of advancing a political agenda, or possibly with the intent of advancing a political agenda, but it's presented as a straight news story, and I think that's a real problem.
Well, you keep bringing up the Franklin Center, and they actually do sessions and such at the America for Prosperity stuff. So there's a huge tie between them and, you know, Franklin Center and America for Prosperity. If you're linking the Franklin Center with some of these groups, then there's, you know, it's a little bit of a curvy road, but there's a pretty direct link with that.
Yeah, and like I said, there Franklin Center is also a member of ALEC, or has exhibited at the ALEC conference. So there's a whole network of these groups out there, and in many ways they seem to be working, if not coordinating, at least working to advance similar goals. The Franklin Center also gets money from the Bradley Foundation. That's the big right wing Milwaukee foundation. That gives a lot of money to groups like Franklin Center, as well as many other right-wing groups.
How is the Bradley Foundation then tied in with the MacGyver Institute? Is it just, again, they just funnel money through these groups that just put it into the MacGyver Institute?
I'm not sure if MacGyver gets money from the Bradley Foundation or not. I can check into that.
It just is interesting to see how these things are all interconnected. What other groups are connected to the MacGyver Institute other than a lot of these media outlets?
Yeah, well, so also Americans for Prosperity, they, you know, not only have they worked closely together on this ad campaign, but Mark Block, who was the former state director of the Wisconsin chapter for Americans for Prosperity, has been closely associated with MacGyver. He was their former treasurer. I think he may have been on the board. I'm not sure about that. But Block also drew scrutiny in the past year or so because he was the campaign director for Herman Cain, and he was in that famous Smoking Man ad. And Cain also famously said that he was the Koch brothers' brother from another mother. And Block has been closely associated with the Koch brothers and with Americans for Prosperity, and has also been fined in the past for getting involved in campaign finance violations. And the president of MacGyver Institute is Brett Keeley, who worked for Scott Jensen for 12 years, and was Jensen's chief of staff during the time that that Jensen was brought up on criminal charges. So these guys are all kind of intertwined with folks who have been around Wisconsin politics for a long time and are funded by a network of national right-wing groups, and they're usually, in many ways, trying to pass themselves off as a nonpartisan or as a neutral organization.
Well, Brandon, can you hold on for a second? We're going to go to a break. Do you mind holding on through the break?
Sure.
Okay. I'll put you on hold there. Thank you so much, Brandon. We are speaking with Brendan Fisher from the Center for Media Democracy. We're talking about the MacGyver Institute in Wisconsin. And you're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
Welcome back to the Sarah Schultz Show, Sarah Schultz. We're just going to finish up real fast with Brendan Fisher. Now, Brendan, if people want more information, where could they go?
You can visit our website, prwatch.org. That's where we do our investigative reporting on, particularly on the American Legislative Exchange Council and other activities in the state and around the country.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being on today, and I hope we can have you on again.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks. Have a great day.
You too.
Thanks. Bye. Again, that was Brendan Fisher from the Center for Media Democracy. And we have now Mayor Tom Barrett, who is running for governor in the recall election. Good morning, Mayor Barrett. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
It's an honor to be on your show, Sarah.
Well, I'm going to ask you the first question that almost everyone asks you when you start talking to them. Why did you decide to run for governor again?
Well, I look at what's happened to our state, Sarah, and it obviously upsets me as it upsets hundreds of thousands of other people who were involved in the recall petition, signed the recall petition, who were out in Madison during the last year. Because last February, Scott Walker, in essence, started a civil war in the state. The day after the Super Bowl, he told his cabinet that he was going to, and these are his words, not mine, drop the bomb. And he did drop the bomb. And that has led to the most acrimonious 15 months of political infighting that this state has ever seen. And we have a situation now where people in the state, neighbors don't want to talk to neighbors, coworkers don't want to talk to coworkers, relatives don't want to talk to coworkers about politics because it becomes too bitter and too divisive. And I'll end the Civil War. And you look at that and you combine it with the first casualty of the Civil War, because every war has casualties. And the first casualty of his Civil War was jobs. And to have Wisconsin ranked dead last in the last year, the only state to have lost jobs, demonstrates that he wanted to have an ideological war, and he wasn't interested in doing what he said he was interested in doing as a candidate, and that is working to retain and create jobs in the state of Wisconsin.
Well, how would you end that Civil War? How would you bring people together and bridge some of these differences that Walker has caused?
Well, I think the first thing you have to do is stop trying to divide people, because I think people can see that we had the very bitter debate over collective bargaining. And there were several key points during that debate and subsequent to that debate where he could have shown a willingness to work with people. The first one clearly was the point at which the union leaders said that their employees would pay towards health care and pensions. That was a political equivalent of crying uncle in a fight. And he had said during the campaign that that's what he was interested in. But by not accepting that offer and instead forging ahead and saying that he had to take away people's collective bargaining rights, it demonstrated that this really wasn't about paying for health insurance. It wasn't about paying for pensions. It was all about stripping people of their rights. And he made that very, very clear. And then you fast forward to what he did in a wide range of areas, and most recently the war on women, the bill that repeals provision equal pay for equal work law, the attacks on cervical cancer screening, on breast cancer screening, and allowing women to make decisions in consultation with their physician rather than in consultation with their state representative. All of those show that he hasn't taken his foot off the accelerator in this extreme right-wing drive. And what he's been doing, rather than trying to show he wants to work with people, is he's been going around the country saying, well, if we are successful here, this is the beginning of a national movement. And I think that's what he's interested in. I think he's interested in the ideological war, spreading this ideological war, and he certainly hasn't been working on trade jobs in the state. So what I would have done differently is I certainly would not have launched this ideological war. We'll end it. We'll work to restore collective bargaining rights, and I'll be a governor who focuses on jobs in this state rather than trying to please right-wing extremists in Illinois or Oklahoma or Texas or California or any of the states that he's traveled through.
Well, what will you do to develop a more credible business environment to get businesses interested in Wisconsin?
Well, it's interesting because one of the things that Scott Walker says is the reason that businesses are not investing in the state right now is because of the unrest here. And there may be there may be some truth to that, but what he doesn't say is he started the unrest. And so for him, the man who created the problem, to identify the problem, but not identify that he is the major portion of that problem, underscores just how blind he is to what he has created here in the state of Wisconsin. So replacing him in and of itself, I think, is going to demonstrate to this entire state, not just the business community, but to this entire state, that this civil war has ended.
What kind of jobs would you bring back into Wisconsin? I think we lost Talgo, and we've lost several others to the state of Illinois. Are you going to bring those jobs back? Are you looking at something different?
I'd love to. And let me just talk about two specific areas. And you mentioned Talgo. I'll talk about that second. But the first one I want to discuss is alternative energy sources, and in particular wind energy. Because one of the things he did, it didn't receive nearly the amount of attention that the collective bargaining changes received, but did have an economic impact on the state. It certainly had an impact on employment in the state. Prior to his election, there was
was a very, very carefully compromised bipartisan agreement having to deal with wind energy and wind turbines in particular for siting here in the state of Wisconsin. And that months and months of work had gone into that. When he came in, he immediately set that to the side. And what happened as a result of that is you had seven wind energy projects in the state of Wisconsin that were either canceled or postponed. And the net construction impact, not operating impact, but construction impact of that was probably 750 to 900 jobs. So right there was 900 jobs that he pushed out of this state for ideological reasons. And that doesn't count probably the 50 or 60 jobs that you would have for operating and maintaining these sources of energy. But that's an example. Talgo is a second example, because as a mayor of Milwaukee, and every mayor has this, companies that have mass layoffs are required by law to inform us of those mass layoffs. And it was a couple weeks ago that I got a notice from Talgo of mass layoffs. And the reason for those mass layoffs is because the governor and legislature have terminated the contract for maintenance of train cars at the Talgo facility. And I would not be in the least bit surprised if this ends up in litigation in the courts. It sends a horrible message to Talgo and the companies from Europe that Talgo could conceivably help us get over here. Because think of it this way, if you're Talgo and this just happened to you, what are you going to say to your business partners or your business friends in Spain or in Europe? That you do business with the state of Wisconsin and for political reasons they may terminate a contract? To me, that's the type of behavior that we have to end.
Did you see any help from Ryan or Senator Johnson at all to save Talgo? Obviously, Governor Walker didn't seem to do much to help save it.
Well, not only did Governor Walker not do much to save it, he was the instigator to drive those jobs out. Again, there can be no confusion about this. It was his administration that terminated the contract that directly resulted in the mass layoffs at Talgo. The documents are there. They established that. And these were jobs in the central city of Milwaukee that we needed. And so to drive those jobs out is just simply wrong.
Do you believe that the business community, especially the Republican businessmen, especially in light of obviously what's going on with some of these things like Talgo, are they ready to drop the divisive political ideology and get down to doing what is best for Wisconsin and its citizens?
Well, I don't think that the business community is monolithic. I think that there are individuals. Business community is made up of many, many different individuals from throughout the state. And there's a wide range of opinions there. You're going to have a lot of people that support Scott Walker, but there are going to be individuals who are looking at this and looking at the job situation in the state and say, how can this be? How can the state of Wisconsin be the worst state in the country when it comes to jobs? And I think as more business people and others in the state ask themselves that question, the inevitable conclusion is we've got a governor here who not only doesn't focus on jobs, but would much prefer to spend his time traveling around the country giving speeches about how much fun he had in taking away workers' rights.
With jobs, do you feel that a green economy is something that Wisconsin would do well in Wisconsin? Is that something you would work for to bring in to help create the jobs and do something for the amount that we've lost with Walker?
Absolutely, yes. And again, I talked a little bit about the work that I would try to bring back in terms of wind energy, but solar energy, certainly, again, in my community, in Menominee Valley, we took what was an industrial wasteland and transformed it into a place where there's now 4,000 jobs, and many of those are in alternative energy sources. There's jobs in food production. So there are many areas where I would love to see us actively promote jobs in the state. Because clearly that's the major need for Wisconsin right now.
And where do you stand with Act 10? I know that some of your opponents have signed with the union saying that they would put it into the budget. Others of your opponents have said that they were going to bring it up separately from the budget. Where do you stand with Act 10 and workers' rights?
Well, But I would use a multifaceted approach to restoring collective bargaining rights and rights for workers. And the first thing I would explore is holding a special session and seeking to have those rights brought back in a special session. If that were not successful, we would focus on having a freestanding bill. We would also consider doing it in the budget. But to me, it's more important to reach the destination than the exact vehicle in which you travel to that destination.
And if people want more information on your campaign, where can they go to, Mayor?
They can go to www.barrettforwisconsin.com. We also have a Facebook, lots of ways to get information on the campaign.
Is it Barrett for F-O-R or Barrett for...
Barrett F-O-R Wisconsin.
Okay. Well, good luck in the campaign. Thank you so much for being on.
Sure, it's a pleasure to be on your show.
And I'm hoping we'll have you on again.
Okay, sounds great.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We were just speaking with Mayor Barrett, Tom Barrett, who is running for governor in the recall election. We're going to go to a quick break, and after that, we'll have Kelly Albright on from Politico.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. National Association of Letter Carriers President Frederick Rolando says the 21st Century Postal Service Act passed by the U.S. Senate is a deeply flawed bill that will cost 80,000 jobs. The union says it's disappointed but determined to fight on to save the Postal Service without embracing a downsizing strategy. Rolando says while this bill reduces the cost of the retirement pre-funding mandate that costs the Postal Service billions of dollars, that mandate is still too heavy to allow the USPS to regain sound financial footing. Imagine a Republican Party that understood working families are part of its constituency, a GOP that stood with working families instead of against them on the whole range of public policies. David Fagan is chairman of Lunch Pail Republicans, a group started in Indiana that has since spread to Illinois and to Wisconsin and may go national. Fagan is also president of Indiana's International Union of Operating Engineers. He says in Indiana, about half of all union members vote Republican, and the party should not turn its back on working families by attacking unions and undermining worker wages with things like the so-called right to work law.
Right to work was not about job creation. Right to work was about depriving people who engage in collective bargaining from the ability to participate in the political process. And the Republican Party should be about creating a foundation for economic growth in the private sector, not pursuing policies that undermine the wages of working families. Their disposable income diminishes, so does their ability to support their local businesses.
Lunch Pail Republicans has recruited pro-working family Republicans to run for state legislative offices in the May primaries in Indiana.
We have a couple of teachers who are running. We have an electrician. We have several operating engineers. We have a member of the Fraternal Order of Police who are running as Lunch Pail Republicans.
The Change to Win Labor Federation says the public needs to send Walmart a message about its alleged bribery of Mexican officials to expand in that country. Change to Win says Walmart reportedly bribed public officials in Mexico to evade laws designed to protect workers, the environment, and communities, and then tried to cover it up. Change to Win is urging people to sign an online petition calling for the resignations of Walmart Board Chair Rob Walton and CEO Mike Duke and a thorough and independent investigation of Walmart's actions. That petition is at change.org. This newscast made possible in part by the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show, Sarah Schultz, and we now have Kelly Albright from Politiscoop. Good morning, Kelly.
Good morning, Sarah.
How are you doing this morning?
I'm fantastic.
Good. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. Now, there are some new updates in the Bo Morrison murder case. Can you get everyone up to speed on that?
Yeah. The website globalgrind.com, they actually got an attorney for the family to force them to release the the 911 call, the original, because it was edited. And when Politiscope was talking with the Washington County Sheriff's Office, they said that we needed to get a lawyer because there was no way they were going to release the 911 tape. And we had asked them, you know, because we heard that it was edited out. You could clearly tell that it skipped the conversation, a piece of it. And so we asked them, you know, what was deleted? And they told us that it was the names of the people were deleted and or redacted. And, you know, we didn't believe that from the beginning, but we had no proof because we couldn't get access to the 911 call. So we're really grateful that the Google Grind was able to force them to release the 911 call. And what was said at the one point where you could hear on the tape, you could hear Mr. Klein say, stupid effing, and it was cut out.
I was going to say, be careful. We're on radio, so be very careful. I don't have a little button either to stop you, so.
Yeah, nope, I'm trying to be very cautious because this is pretty inflammatory. And so we had asked, when we were talking to the Washington County Sheriff, we had asked them, you know, what was the word that came after that? And he had said, kid. And, of course, we were suspicious. We're like, well, why would you redact that out? You know, why would you leave the rest of it and just take out the word kid? So we were pretty suspicious. And so when the original 911 call was released, it did confirm that he did say kid in finishing that sentence. But it's now been sent off to try to clarify the other parts that were redacted. And what they think that they said without having it already edited and cleared up, they think that he said, he uses the N-word in there, so I'm trying to be very careful. But it was something to do with these N-word are always doing this. So whatever that was. But, he was very enraged before he even made the call, you know, before the shooting, when he called the police about the kids' party going on. And he repeats it three or four times in the call. I'm fed up with this. People in and out all the time. He repeats that several times, and he says the parents won't do anything about it. And he's very angry when he's saying this, which leads me to believe that that he was going to take matters into his own hands.
All right, Kelly, wait. I'm gonna hold you up because you're talking about a couple different things going on here. Number one, let's go back. Who was the group again who was going to sue Washington County?
GlobalGrind.com.
And that is Russell Simmons' group, is that not correct?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Okay.
Yes.
And he is, for those who don't know, why don't you tell them who Russell Simmons are for those who don't know the name?
He's a pretty famous rapper.
It's Jay-Z.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a mogul. He's a billionaire, millionaire mogul empire.
Yeah, and was so grateful that he got involved and helped this family, you know, find some kind of peace for him and get to the bottom of what really happened.
Okay, and so on the 911 call, because there's two 911 calls that Mr. Kine made that night. The one 911 call that you were talking about him being angry was the first one because of the noise, because what was going on next door was a party. Is that not correct?
Yes. And, you know, in that call, after that call, or just before that call, he had gone out to talk to some kids that were in a vehicle and you know, told him to leave or whatever, but he was very, very angry. And you know, I find it amazing that he felt comfortable with going out and confronting the kids at that time. And then later, all of a sudden, you know, he has fear for his family and, you know, over some kids partying.
Now, was this party a strictly African-American party, or is it a mixed party? Who was there? Is it all
white? I don't know the specifics, but I'm pretty sure that it was mostly white kids there.
Okay. Now, after the first 911 call, which he was complaining about the noise, that this is the second 911 call that he did after he shot Bill Morrison. I'd say allegedly shot, but I think it's been confirmed that he actually was the shooter on this. Now, that second 911 tape, and it's in as the wife is on the phone, it's a very, actually, if you get a chance, JS Online, the Journal Sentinel Online, has the whole thing, and we only have a couple minutes left, so we're going to have to cut it down. But they had the whole thing. It's a 4-minute call. It's very bizarre because the wife is on the phone talking, and then she's yelling at the husband. The husband is yelling back at her. So they're going, is he alive? Is he breathing? Is he breathing? I mean, it's just a very strange conversation altogether. It's very strange. If you can listen to it. But it's in that call, the second 911 call that he does, that you hear him in the background say these things. And that was the 911 call that was redacted. That was the one that they had said that they cut out a portion of it because they're concerned about the names being used. But But what they actually did cut out was him saying effing kids, and I believe he said the N-word.
All these N do something. It's kind of what we got out of it.
It's because it's in the background. It's him yelling at this time in the background,
yeah.
And I believe that. And I don't quote me, but I believe Russell Simmons's blog is going to be trying to clear that up so we can actually hear what was being said.
Yes. And that's really key. I think, you know, in his language and how he's acting, it really tells me that this is more of a hate crime. And I'm confident that that Russell is going to be getting the federal prosecutors involved in this. This is going to get bigger.
Now, has Washington County redacted 911 calls and 911 tapes before?
I have no idea. I do know that in the unredacted call, there was no mention of names in that call. So why they chose to lie and say that they redacted names from being publicly, it just doesn't make any sense. Why would the police cover up those words and then lie and say that it was, you know, revealing names?
Now, I think, and we've got about a minute left, but I believe that she said her name right away. And then that was it. But when he started saying effing kids and the N-word, that's 2 to 3 minutes into the call.
Yes.
Believe there's any names at that point being used.
Yeah, and the edited call was 5 minutes and 19 seconds, and the unredacted call was 6 minutes and 39 seconds.
So
there's almost a minute of redacted
That they cut out. Well,
yeah.
Kelly, I got to go. Thank you so much for being on. I'm going to keep following this because it's a horrible story, and I know you guys are really doing a good job at keeping up with it as well. We'll have you on again as soon as we hear more.
Yes, we cannot let this rest. No justice, no peace. We have to keep this in the forefront and not let them make it go away.
That's right. We have to be on top of this. So thank you so much for being on, and we'll have you on soon.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Kelly Albright. She's with Politiscope, and they have been very good at following the Beau Morrison murder investigation. You could go see more at www.politiscope.com. Well, I'd like to thank you all for listening to the Sarah Schultz Show today. I'd like to thank my producer, Bill, for his hard work on the show. And the music you heard today was from Ida Joe and the show. I will have links to her website on my Facebook page. You can download the show from iTunes or listen to the archive shows at www.blogtalkradio.com/Sarah Schultz. You can also listen to the Sarah Schultz Show off the free Sarah Schultz Show app for Androids and iPhones. And you can tune in Saturdays to WIDE 99.1 LPFM in Madison, Sundays to WFAQ 92.9 LPFM in Mifwanaga, Waukesha, and Tuesdays to WHYS 96.3 LPFM in Eau Claire. Remember, Wisconsin, 11 days left until the recall primary. Make sure you are registered to vote. Have a great week, everybody. We'll see you next Friday.